Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into an all-new episode of Can We Please Talk podcast. As always, I'm Mike Leon.
And looking for a separate or a new interpreter myself, I'm Nick Saberi.
Oh, man. We're going to get into that story. If you have not been following the MLB investigation into Shohei Ohtani, we're going to be getting that. Not in this episode. Coming up soon. On the program for us today, Congress keeps the government open. Marjorie Taylor Greene wants to get rid of the guy that helped keep the government open. Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin says, I don't want to work here for the government anymore. All of that and more inside another crazy week on Capitol Hill. Plus, later on the program, Bloomberg News correspondent. She's the author of the book Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. Our friend Saleha Mohsen joins the pod to discuss the book, The Power of the U.S. Treasury, Nick. We're going to find out all about that and more when Saleha joins us in just a bit. And finally, in our last segment, we say farewell to a TV contributor who never really got to contribute. It's not me. Spoiler alert. More on that in just a bit. Some housekeeping notes before I say hello to my co-host, Nick Saberi. An all-new episode of Back Your Play is out there with Q. Q breaks down March Madness. This is it. We're in this run right now. Oakland had a little bit of a mini run, got ousted in the round of 32. The Sweet 16 is all set. The ACC's got four teams, and Q's got you covered. He breaks it all down with an all-new episode of Back Your Play with Q over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen to it wherever you get your pods. And an all-new episode of the If You Lead Them podcast is out there now. Shout out to our friend Katie Barnett. This past week, Katie had a fantastic episode. She welcomed in January Donovan, a two-time number one best-selling author, entrepreneur, a mother of eight. That's right. I said eight. Mother of eight. I don't know how she found the time to write two books and be a mom of eight. She's the founder of the Woman School and the Wholeness Coaching School. She joins the pod to talk about her 20 plus years of experience training women. She's been featured in Forbes' top self-worth coaching programs. I want you to go check out this episode of the If You Lead Them podcast over on leonmedianetwork.com or listen to it wherever you get your pods. Now I say hello to my co-host, Nick Saberi, who's got an interesting shirt on, Stardate. What is that shirt that you're wearing before I say hello to you? I know you want to give a quick plug to a friend of yours. What is this T-shirt that you got here?
Thank you. This is from the artwork of my boy, Toby Roberts. Toby, I've known Toby about as long as I've known you. We've just became friends at work. So just through various things we've done. So Toby's a phenomenal artist. This was done through just some AI influenced artwork. So but it's an album cover for a fictional rap group that he's actually just further developing. So this is a like we're talking. Yeah. So album covers here. There's a picture of one of the band members in the back. So I'm excited to wear it. It finally just came in. So I promised my guy I'd wear the shirt mentioned on the show. This shirt, though, a little back here, can be found over at, if you through the link tree, Wind Water Cloud. I'll post it on my Instagram and, you know, Twitter and all that good stuff. But yeah, this is actually Toby's artwork, though, so I'm excited about it. Images like this you can get through his space. So I will, as I said, I'll promote it, put it up there. Mike already took a picture of us, you know, on camera in this way, so you get a chance to see it. But yeah, I've already had some people, you know, I wore this today and we took our girls to their swim class, and people already came up to me. I was like, well, yeah, it's good. Band? What is
it's
that?
It's a good, looking shirt. It's like an album cover. That's yeah, right on the shirt.
I saw it. So I was like, I like that image. And he's like, yeah, I have an Etsy store. So I purchased it there. It came the other day. So thank you for bringing it up.
You're welcome.
All's good. You know, it's, you know, obviously weather's getting a little bit warmer, you know, soon to be baseball season. So there's always not the, like the most avid baseball viewer, but it's the time of the year. So it's just, you know, it's always exciting. So, but as I joked about, as you teased, you know, with baseball upon us, equally as huge as a very big looming story involving the sport.
Oh yeah, man. With that story is wild. Again, we're going to get into that later on, because again, it's still in the early phases. For those of you who don't watch sports and don't know anything about what's going on, just picture the biggest, most influential person in the sport right now, potentially being involved in like money laundering, gambling, and there could be a cover-up. The story has changed. I've been following this almost as close as somebody who's obsessed with the royal family has been following Kate Middleton. And, you know, shout out to her. I know she has what's going on with her cancer scare and the treatment and stuff like that. So let's get into our first segment here, though, Nick, as we get into this, because this past week was a crazy week out in Congress. First and foremost, we've been talking about government shutdown looming, continuing resolutions that have continued to be signed, Speaker Johnson, and that just continues to do extensions of keeping the government open for 45 days, right? 45 days here, 45 days here. I feel like we've been talking about it for forever. Well, this past Saturday, President Biden signed a massive spending package that the Senate approved overnight, Nick. Think about this. The Senate, Saturday night, overnight approving this 74-24. The House had voted earlier in the day on it, 286-134. It passed a $1.2 trillion package. And so this approved, obviously, funding for a couple of things. Three quarters of the government will now be open until the end of the fiscal year. The bill includes money for the Departments of State, Homeland Security, Defense, Labor, Health and Human Services, and also provides, obviously, funds for foreign operations, financial services, the legislative branch. It allows Congress to shift its focus now to other priorities, including next year's spending bills that need to be signed into law by October. And the biggest thing, the biggest holdup that's been at the top of Dems and Republicans' talking points as they go on different networks, foreign aid. Israel, Ukraine, those things have been in limbo for months. But now, because of this, you know, bipartisan nature, signing this and President Biden signing it into law, now the government is open. But with that came a threat, not really a threat, more of a promise, as Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene was out on the steps of the Capitol just that Friday. Okay. As this was getting announced, she laid the groundwork for an eventual vote to strip House Speaker Mike Johnson of the gavel after this was about to get passed. Take a listen to what she said.
Today I filed a motion to vacate after Speaker Johnson has betrayed our conference and broken our rules. We were promised regular order. That's what our conference had started out as, with rules and promises to the American people that we would bring regular order back to Congress. Speaker Johnson has betrayed that by passing three CRs and then forcing us to pass to vote on a two-part omnibus, the second one being today. He also only gave us, I mean, I don't even know, how, we had one day basically to read 1,012 pages, breaking the 72-hour rule. This is a betrayal of the American people. This is a betrayal of Republican voters. And the bill that we were forced to vote on forced Republicans to choose between funding to pay our soldiers And in doing so, funding late-term abortion. This bill was basically a dream and a wish list for Democrats and for the White House. It was completely led by Chuck Schumer, not our Republican Speaker of the House, not our conference, and we weren't even allowed to put amendments to the floor to have a chance to make changes to the bill.
Now, a couple of things I want to note there, because, again, she is putting this in motion, right, to vacate. Then it's got to get seconded and then it's going to get a vote on, right? So it's really more of a warning shot, but I do want people to know, like, so she hasn't said that she's about to go through the process, as I just laid out there, of getting this in place and getting him ousted. And also, we don't know if it'll have the votes or whatnot. And the other big thing to note is the House and Congress in general is going to be leaving Washington for a 2-week recess after the votes that just happened this past Friday. Now they're on a 2-week break. They're on their spring break. So maybe you'll see some photos of some Congress folks out on vacation. And it's because they're off for 2 weeks, which is why this bill, this $1.2 trillion spending package that helped avoid this government shutdown, needed to be passed before Congress went on this recess. And that's why she was going nuts, as you just heard there. House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who, if you remember during the Kevin McCarthy stuff, was one of the folks that was being considered for Speaker of the House. He told reporters after Marjorie Taylor Greene spoke on the Capitol steps, he told reporters, hey, I don't believe Johnson will be removed as Speaker. And this is more of, kind of smoke, but it'll get tamped down. I'm paraphrasing what he said there. You can go check out his full quotes. Nick, real quick, before I get to you, the former Speaker of the House, the guy who got ousted a while back, Kevin McCarthy, if you're keeping track of all of this, Kevin McCarthy, and then Patrick McHenry had it for like 10 minutes because, you know, they couldn't find one. And then, you know, they were going to give him some power. Then they didn't. Then they obviously put Mike Johnson into place. He came out of left field after tons of votes for other people that you won't even know if you couldn't pick them out of a police lineup if I told you who they were. But Kevin McCarthy was on the Sunday shows this past weekend. He was on CBS Face the Nation. He had to say this about all of the antics and drama. And is Mike Johnson going to last in all this? Remember, he has the most experience getting ousted by this conference. Take a listen to what he said.
Do you endorse her tactic? What's the game here?
Look, the one thing I've always found, when you sit down with a member and talk to them, find out what their concerns are, especially when it's based upon policy, you can solve that problem. And I watched that with Marjorie, from the vote to Speaker to the vote for the Fiscal Responsibility Act. There's times she was a difference of opinion, and you sit down and find common ground. Matt's case was much different. It's about a personal thing that he had done, and that's what he was trying to get something illegally stopped. This is not the case here.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, at its core, yes, Matt did not like Kevin, so that was different. Marjorie hasn't made this really about Mike Johnson. She's made it more about the bill itself and not passing. But what says Nick Saveri about all of this? First, at a high level, the government shut down. We can put that to bed at least through the end of the year. That's been averted. And now those key departments and agencies will get the funding that they need to operate through the rest of the fiscal year. And calendar year, I believe. So that's taken care of. That's part one. The second part is the antics of the woman representing the 14th district out there in Georgia. She's been the bane of our existence, you and I personally, and for a lot of people as well, too, as a sitting member of Congress who is not serious, to quote Logan Roy, in our opinion. What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, that comment she made about that this helps to fund late-term abortions. I mean, I've tried to read the text of the bill. I can't see that. So that, to me, just sounds like a foolish. No. So this is just yet another tactic by a fringe Republican that is, you know, just trying to obstruct any form of bipartisan collaboration. You know, what's weird is that, you know, I often wonder for a Republican like her or any member of Congress who refuses to have any wiggle room to negotiate, what exactly do they think their job is? Because if she's supposed to represent, now, fun fact, you mentioned that she represents Georgia 14. That's true, but she originally ran for Georgia 7. Actually, she ran for, if I remember correctly, she'd run for Georgia 7, then jumped over the 6, and then ran in Georgia 14. So you have to wonder, does she actually know anything about the respective districts that she's been a part of? Now, in the state of Georgia, as long as you live within the state, you can run, you know, for Congress. So obviously she's well within the law. But, you know, when we've had members of Congress on this show, we always make it a point to talk about their respective district, because I'm always interested in, you know, how familiar are people with truly the constituents they serve? I think oftentimes members of the House, and this is sometimes true about members of the Senate, sometimes forget who they should be listening to, which is their constituents. So, you know, this is at best, or at least a friendly way of my saying that she has a little bit of carpet bagginess to her. You know, as far as Marjorie Taylor Greene's career, now her current salary is about $176,000, which is, you know, well over the average median income for the average American citizen, which is currently about $67,000. I bring this up because here's a person who's wholly unqualified to this job, but meanwhile, you know, wants to hang an axe over yet another speaker. You know, this person who, you know, got into business by purchasing her dad's contractual company. I'm curious how much she actually spent for that. She was listed as CFO of said company, but was found out that she really had nothing to do with the job. This is according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Of course, she then jumped over to CrossFit, where she worked part-time and then opened up her own gym. Very cool for her. And then she wrote articles, really blog posts, for the American Truth Seekers and Law Enforcement Today, both of which have spewed anti-government rhetoric and basically falsified information. Then she eventually joined the Family American Project, and, you know, most notably moderate their Facebook page. Always impressive. In 2021, she won unopposed. You know, the Democrat pulled back. To her credit, in 2022, she won with about 65% of the vote. So I bring all this up to say, as you mentioned before, she is not a serious person. Now, listen, I know someone who's a CrossFit trainer. Could this person potentially run for Congress? Well, he's a lot more intelligent than she is. So what you do professionally before you step into Congress, I'm not so critical of. But she has no track record to be a public servant. And in the time she's been a public servant, she's basically just been an obstructionist. So I really wonder, what does she think her job is? If it is about trying to reduce federal spending, well, then what is her plan? In general, I'm curious, what are Republicans' plans for spending? Because at least this version of the party seems to be very okay with Congress doing nothing, as though her district, which will, of course, benefit from infrastructure spending and other, the CHIPS Act and things like that. But this is yet another Republican that just wants to be an obstructionist, that just wants to stay in the way of anything being done. So she's not serious. She's also been kicked out of the House Freedom Caucus. I forget. I don't know if we remember this, but she had gone after Representative Lauren Boebert in some kind of exchange, and then she was booted. So she really is a person without a country, to quote Avon Barksdale. I don't know what to take of her, Representative Scalise's comments, you know, to be considered there. And what she did was not really put a lot back into that comment, but she basically fired a warning shot. She decides to go forward with that motion as she can, you know, from what we saw with the previous deal with McCarthy. That may be enough to start the vote, but I don't think she's going to probably get the votes. And, you know, we'll see what happens when she's up for re-election this year.
Yeah, she's probably not going to get the votes, let's be honest. And again, for the people that are wondering, the current rules of the House allow for any single lawmaker, Democrat or Republican, make a motion to vote to vacate the chair, which is essentially a vote to oust the speaker. And it's through a privileged resolution. So this is according to the Associated Press. So if you want to check out how this happened, again, to Speaker McCarthy. So we have history and precedent with it just happening within the last 6 months. But I don't think she would, you know, then it would have to go to the floor. Because at any point in time, remember, the House can introduce this. And then once the motion's introduced, now obviously you go on the House floor, you request a vote. And now that's got to come within 2 legislative days. And like I just mentioned, they're going to be on recess for the next 2 weeks. So they could table her motion, which will further delay it and probably kill it. And they may not have the votes, because the last part of this, Nick, before we go to the break, Republican Representative Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin just decided he's going to resign early. He was not going to seek re-election in November, and now he's leaving April 19th. This is after another Republican member, Ken Buck of Colorado, left this past Friday as well.
Gallagher says he's departing April 19th, and it's going to leave Republicans with just one vote to spare on legislation. Take a listen to the way it was covered with the local Wisconsin affiliate out there, the ABC 7 affiliate.
Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher represents the 8th Congressional District. That's up near Green Bay. Gallagher confirmed last month he would not be seeking re-election. Now he says he's leaving Congress even earlier. Gallagher's term was set to end next January, but in a statement he released today, he said, quote, "After conversations with my family, I have made the decision to resign from my position effective April 19, 2024. Going on to say he was working with Republican leadership in the House to appoint a new chair to serve on the Chinese Communist Party subcommittee. Gallagher's decision to vacate his seat is yet another blow to House Speaker Mike Johnson, further narrowing majorities for the GOP conference in the House. Republican Representative Ken Burke of Colorado is set to leave Congress this week, cutting the GOP's majority down to 218 seats, with the Democratic caucus maintaining its 213 seats.
A source close to Gallagher, this is according to NBC News, said that the decision to leave was in the works and it wasn't related to anything that's been happening in the House. Now, again, tough optics wise for all of us to see a few members on the Republican side, the dysfunction. We've talked about Representative Chip Roy and what he said about, give me one thing that we've passed that I can take back to my constituents. You just heard Representative Jasmine Crockett in our last episode saying that the 118th Congress will go down in history for the fewest amount of bills passed legislatively during their tenure. And now Gallagher's leaving. Ken Buck, who was a longtime fixture, he's leaving now. So a few open seats. It's going to be interesting come November. Do those seats flip? I don't believe. Well, I mean, in Ken Buck's case, Colorado has been flipping race recently. I have to check in the Green Bay district what it's done. But what do you make of now? Gallagher's around our age, Nick. He's a 40-year-old guy, you know, Iraq war veteran. He's got a couple of young kids. You know, he wants to grow his family. So that's why he's saying that he's, you know, this has nothing to do with politics. But the last episode, we just had a member of Congress tell us they hate politics, but they think that they're serving a greater good. What do you make of somebody who's around our age group and trying to make a difference, gets elected, and then all of a sudden, within a couple of years, he's like, I can't do this anymore, and I want out. What do you make of it?
You know, the biggest thing that keeps concerning me, and I know I sound like the old man shaking his fist in network, but for a while now, it's definitely looked more and more like becoming a member of Congress, especially the House, is basically an opportunity to build your brand. It's not about governing. It's about building up your persona. And we've seen this with Democrats, although Democrats, funny enough, I feel like have started to be more political and really lean into the job. I mean, we've seen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who we've seen less of really through social media and really trying to do more of the job of governing in her district in New York and being the representative. But, you know, to the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the Lauren Boberts, you know, we've seen folks that are not serious people that continue that, you know, win these elections. And I'm not quite sure what their aims are. You know, these are not people who try to put forward any bills. You know, they tend to just shoot down all ideas. So what exactly do they want to bring forward? And I'm not the only person that's noticing, you know, coming up now, we're looking at 41 members of the House that are not seeking re-election. That's almost like 10%. I think currently House Representatives, I think, has about like 435 people. So it's a little less than 10%, but still a sizable number. Now, of that breakdown, you know, 12 members, 3 Republicans, 9 Democrats, they're running for Senate. So they're looking for an upgrade. 2 of which, you know, 1 Democrat, 1 Republican are running for state attorney general. 2 making up 1 Democrat, 1 Republican are running for governor. 1 Democrat, of course, is running for president of the United States. You know, we've talked about him previously. And then 24, 11 Democrats and 13 Republicans are simply retiring from public office. So, and in the case of Gallagher, he would be one of those. But that's still a sizable number of people that are leaving. And it does beg the question, if Congress has become so dysfunctional, is this the job that people want? I texted you earlier today, Mike, and I said that we're getting to a place where, you know, does this become so undesirable that this becomes almost like jury duty, that we just mandate every couple of years, you're putting in people, you know, capable people that should be a part of that decision-making process, which when you think of sort of the origins of our government is kind of what happened. You just had, you know, ordinary citizens with an opportunity. Of course, granted, you know, they were not African American, essentially just, you know, white males only, but you had people that, you know, were brought together to try to help form a government. Right now, that's not the purpose of the House, or at least not seemingly so.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's a good point, by the way. Can you imagine, like, jury duty, and now we get called in to actually serve as a member of Congress? Well, we leave it there. I mean, the chaos is going to continue to unfold. We'll see if the motion goes anywhere to oust Speaker Johnson. We're going to have a member of Congress, another one, coming up in our next episode. But for this episode, coming up, next segment, Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. Fantastic correspondent over at Bloomberg News. Go check out her podcast. I'm not kidding. Big Take DC. I love it. It's one of my favorite pods. Saleha Mohsin, when we come back after the break.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Nick, today's episode is presented, as always, by our friends over at Fresh Roasted Coffee. Since 2009, their passion has always been bringing you gourmet coffees from all over the world, roasted fresh to order. I got my coffee snob here, Nick Saveri. Nick, tell these people, coffee snob it up here, tell these people why Fresh Roasted Coffee is so good and why they're the official sponsor of Can We Please Talk?
You know, often the best cup of coffee that you're ever going to have is the one you can make from home. And you need good quality coffee to do that. And that's what Fresh Roasted Coffee offers. You know, between single origin, between blends, flavors, anything on the coffee spectrum they've got. But more importantly, and I can't stress this enough, often when you purchase coffee, you don't know where to start. I mean, there's so many different varieties, so many different opportunities, so many different things you could choose from. And Fresh Roasted Coffee just gives you a very simple questionnaire and just says, hey, figure out what your coffee cup is. Figure out what blend works for you. I've gotten some single origin recommendations, so has Mike, and that's influenced everything. And what they recommend, you can get in a Keurig cup, the way Mike takes it. You can take it in the way I do it, which is typically through a French press, or you can get it for a percolator. Whatever coffee machine you've got, they've got you covered. But more importantly, just a huge variety and a way to learn more about coffee itself.
And all of this is available at freshroastedcoffee.com on their site. One cup is all it takes to fall in love with Fresh Roasted Coffee, but you get a discount for being a listener of Can We Please Talk. Enter in the promo code Can We Please Get 20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Head to freshroastedcoffee.com today. Quick break from the pod. As always, we are presented by our friends over at SeatGeek. If you need tickets to the biggest concerts, shows, sporting events, MLB season that's starting up this coming week, you got the NBA and NHL playoffs coming up soon, SeatGeek has got you covered. Nick, did you download the SeatGeek app like I told you?
Did. We're excited to use it because we've got, obviously, the Phillies starting up this season. So I'm excited to take my girls out there and just take full advantage of the perks we get as partners.
That's right, as you should. As should our audience right now. So if you're watching or listening to this, when you download the app, put the tickets in the cart. When you hit the checkout, there's going to be a little promo code field right there. Do me a favor, enter in the promo code Can We Please Talk, all one word. You're going to get $20 off that purchase. Download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com to get your tickets today. All right, a couple months ago, as you know already, folks, as I've been doing the TV circuit, happened to be doing New Hampshire primary coverage. And this young lady handed me her business card and then also told me a little bit about this book that she had coming out in March. Love to be on the show. I was a fan of her work. She did a great job on the panel that night. She joins us here, Saleha Mohsin. She's a senior Washington correspondent over at Bloomberg News. She's the host of one of my favorite podcasts, the Big Take DC podcast. The book that she wrote is called Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the world order. You can see it over, I think, my right shoulder here. If you're watching us on YouTube, left shoulder, Nick's got a copy of it. Saleha, Mike, and Nick, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast with us.
So excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great talking to you and seeing you again, Saleha. You know, there's a bunch we're going to get into with the pod. Obviously, voter issues are always centered around the economy. But first, let's get into the book for a second, because, you know, I was telling you this offline. Nick and I both have our copies of the book here as we start reading this. It's an interesting read. And the high takeaways for our audience that's listening to this, that they hear the title Paper Soldiers. Ooh, sounds interesting. Weaponization of the dollar. Oh, I'm kind of hooked. Why don't you take our audience a little bit more inside of what made you want to write the book and what's the book holistically about?
Yeah, what made me want to write the book was that there's a lot of books about the Federal Reserve. There's a lot of books about different Treasury secretaries, their own autobiographies. We have a great hit musical called Hamilton that's about one of the founding fathers who was the first Treasury secretary that this country has had. But there's no book about Treasury. At the same time, I think people don't realize what the role of the Treasury Department is in our democracy, in our economy. We carry, the U.S. Treasury Department is the steward of the almighty buck, the U.S. dollar. And banknotes, if you pull one out or if you look at the cover of the book, you'll see that a banknote, a dollar bill, says "In God We Trust" printed on it. But actually, it's the strength of U.S. democracy, U.S. institutions that underpin people's faith in the U.S. dollar. And so I was able to draw a connection between our economic power, our currency power, and our democracy. And it actually ties into a lot of what we're seeing today, that the U.S.'s role as a superpower on the world stage, as in a leadership role, is on shaky ground. And a lot of that has to do with what's going on with our democracy internally, what's going on globally in other countries, but it also has deep implications for what could happen to the U.S. dollar and the world because of how connected the rest of the world is to the dollar.
So, like, the opening of your book talks about a pivotal moment being the invasion of Ukraine. And as a fan of history, U.S. and world history, obviously, you know, something that stood out to me even now is 2 years removed from the war. You know, the United States has not fired a single shot, nor is any country in the world outside of Ukraine defending itself. But you put forward the argument that the currency battle, at least the way the dollar, and the way that internally in our government, it was being discussed how to address Russia from a currency economic standpoint, perhaps may have been the greatest weapon we could have used, you know, beyond armaments and, you know, typical weapons of war. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, what we've seen, Nick, is that U.S. sanctions have evolved largely since 2001. Sanctions existed before then, but it was run by an office that before, until 9/11, OFAC, this tiny little office, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, it was just considered the orphan of the Treasury Department, as one former official told me. With 9/11, the U.S. discovered the massive power that comes with holding the world's reserve asset, and that is that you can export our own, we can export our own foreign policy goals and agenda and geopolitical strategies through the dollar. And that's by applying economic sanctions. So if there's someone who is a so-called bad actor, they have brought on humanitarian strife or assaulted another democracy, you name it, the U.S. can say, all right, you are not allowed to use the dollar anymore. Now, that's a very blunt force way of looking at it. There is this spectrum of sanctions where you can slowly tighten the vise and make it harder and harder for a company, an individual, a government, government official to participate in the world economy. And what we've seen happen is over the course of the last quarter of a century, we've seen how the expanding role of sanctions has given the U.S. a new kind of leverage. The way foreign policy works is that you start with diplomacy. And before, if diplomacy failed, just talking to another country, trying to work things out, if that didn't work, a lot of times the next option was war. Let's send military tanks. Let's get our troops and boots on the ground. There wasn't much in between. Economic sanctions is the space in between diplomacy and kinetic action. And it's cheap. We are not spilling American blood. We're not spending money on our own tanks going in and our own people driving those tanks. But at the same time, a lot of other costs come with it in terms of the credibility of the dollar and the country and what happens to the global economy. So we saw President Biden 2 years ago, you know, the book starts February 26, 2022, leverage the biggest sanctions package on earth, on Russia, on the world's 11th largest economy at the time, a G20 country. And it was the kind of sanctions package that actually caused self-inflicted wounds. If you remember, 2 years ago to the day, we were paying more in gas prices. Americans going to the pump to fill up their tanks had to pay more. And a large part of that was because of what was going on in commodities markets and oil markets because of those Russian sanctions. And so that weaponization has become a pretty sharp edge that the U.S. can wield, and it causes problems at home too.
You know, Saleha, you just kind of landed the plane there and kind of fed into this follow-up, because some of the econ stuff, we were joking about this off air about, you know, I failed Econ 101. I think I failed. I'd have to check the transcript at Rutgers University.
I don't believe it.
Well, maybe. I definitely passed communications and journalism, but it's one of the things about your book is that, you know, it's kind of explaining some of this to the lay person. And one of the things that Nick likes to do here, as he's worked in education for forever, is this kind of moment of literacy. So your book attempts to open, you know, the eyes into how the rest of the world looks at our currency as a form of like that economic superpower that you just mentioned. Can you kind of elaborate on that and kind of break down some more of that? Like, people look at it and they go, oh, I don't get it. The US dollar, you know, inflation. I don't get some of these terms. Can you kind of explain that a little bit more?
Absolutely. And that's one of the fun things that I got to do, Mike, in the book is, you know, I take people from inside the halls of power in Washington, where big decisions are made inside the Treasury Department, Congress, or the White House. And then I take you, you'll see a chapter on what was going on in Moraine, Ohio, which is just a couple of hours from where I grew up in Cincinnati, or Weirton, West Virginia, where the manufacturing sort of the Rust Belt state, the manufacturing economy suffered from globalization, which is underpinned by the dollar. But to get to some of the Econ 101 terms, the book starts off with, there's a chapter called Bob Rubin's Bumper Sticker. And in that chapter, I explain why the dollar and any kind of policy even exists, and how Bob Rubin, who is a pretty storied Treasury Secretary from the Clinton era, he created a mantra. It was the strong dollar mantra that lasted more than two decades. And it was, a strong dollar is in the best interests of the nation. And there's a couple of different variations on it. And I explain in the book how there's two types of strength in the dollar. The first is exchange rate, just what the value of the dollar is against the yen or the euro or the pound or any other nation or a combination of currencies. And a strong dollar is good for America. A strong currency exchange rate is good for America because it means that we can buy cheap goods from overseas. And so we have this great consumer-driven economy. Everyone in the world wants to sell to us. If your product or your band or your movie makes it big in the US, you've made it big in the world. And it is cheaper for foreigners to come here and sell those goods. For Americans, it means that we don't have as high inflation, or inflation is at a predictable and stable rate because we can import goods at a lower cost. The flip side of that is what we've seen in the rise of populism, something that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump picked up on before a lot of other people did. And what that is that a strong dollar was not good for everyone in the country. It was not good for the manufacturing sector, which was for a long time the backbone of our economy. Our American-made products, you couldn't sell them because everyone thought, well, I can get a Chinese made or Vietnamese or Bangladeshi or Latin America, something made in Latin America, a lot cheaper than this one that was made here a couple of states over because of the exchange rate dynamics. The second component, or the second definition of a strong dollar, is what I talked about earlier, that it gives us this global strength. The whole world runs on dollars. You could be a business tycoon anywhere in the world, or you could be someone, let's say, who picks cocoa beans in Ghana, and you're trying to sell that, your product, your chocolate, your cocoa beans, to the rest of the world, anyone in the world. you will touch the global financial system to make that sale. That means you will touch the dollar. The dollar is at the center of the whole global financial system.
So Leah, just thinking about your past in terms of as a reporter, you know, when we think about Trump, obviously from a social standpoint, from a domestic standpoint, obviously there's all kinds of conversations, but from an economic standpoint, you know, in your coverage, what did you find to be some of the chief differences between the previous administration and this one as it relates to a clear economic policy, a policy that is beneficial to the Americans and to the rest of the world, or at least respectful of our impact with the rest of the world?
The switch from, so I saw the switch from Obama to Trump and then Trump to Biden. So I've covered three Treasury secretaries. To go from Obama to Trump was a really big rupture. And the U.S. went from supporting globalization to looking inward and looking at isolationist policies, looking at populism and protectionism, the tariffs, and a lot of the other things. And those things are characterized as America first, make America great again. Let's get our own manufacturers going. Let's buy made in America products. And the interesting thing, Nick, is that the first State of the Union speech that Joe Biden gave, it was called the Joint Sessions speech in early 2021. When I listened to that, I thought that some of these things, the core domestic economic policies, capitalize a couple of different letters, change the rhetoric a little bit. And it sounds like what Trump was saying, because Biden uses words like buy America and friendshoring, which is a lot like make America great again and a lot like America first.
You're feeding into these follow-ups perfectly because Nick opened the door there about the differences between these administrations. I want to get into something that you do a great job. And like I mentioned, the Big Take DC is a podcast, a production of Bloomberg. You can go check it out wherever you listen to pods. But you guys recently did an episode, again, a moment of literacy on the Federal Reserve. And who's overseeing that? Jerome Powell, the guy who was appointed by former President Trump, who was kept in office by President Biden. And there's some things in the episode that you and I forget who the other reporter that was joining you from Bloomberg were discussing about. He was recently on Capitol Hill. And the purpose of the Fed is to not be political. It's an apolitical org. It's supposed to be, right? But then President Biden said something about interest rate cuts and that this is something that the White House had to kind of walk back later on. Can you first kind of explain a little bit more of that exchange? But then also at this 30,000 foot overview, what the Federal Reserve's mission is. A lot of people may not know that. I know one talking to you right now doesn't know that fully. So why don't you explain a little bit more about Jerome Powell's role and how he's almost become politicized because there's a huge election happening here in November and people are economies always at the top of voter issues and minds. And Donald Trump has said he thinks that Jerome Powell is acting in a political nature towards President Biden, whereas President Biden has said in reverse, I think you're going to see the Fed do some stuff and you're not supposed to do that. So take our audience inside all of that.
The Federal Reserve is a core part of what makes America's democracy strong, a strong overseas, and our dollar strong. The Federal Reserve is the world's most powerful central bank. It has an immense amount of influence over our day-to-day household costs. Their goal at the Fed, the goal at the Fed is to stay away from politics and achieve what they call a dual mandate, which is a low jobless rate and keep inflation at a stable, predictable, roughly 2% rate. When those two components or even the politicization component go out of whack, then they have their job cut out for them. Now, the two main, their actual mandate from the Congress is their boss, that mandate, looking at unemployment and looking at inflation, their key mechanism is to use interest rates to tinker with the plumbing of the economy, I guess you could say. And that's something that I unpacked on the Big Take DC podcast last week. We aired that in the wake of Powell's visit to Capitol Hill. He had these back-to-back hearings. So I think in 2 days, he testified for 6 hours and was grilled by Senate lawmakers and House lawmakers in their respective financial services committees that oversee what he does. And what he's facing is for the first time in decades since Trump came on the scene, we've seen a president meddling and talking about the Federal Reserve in the way that they shouldn't, because the Fed has the power to immediately give the economy a kick. They can slash interest rates. All of a sudden, the economy will be juiced up, revved up, and hey, voters are happy. They might say the president had something to do with that. That's why there's a separation of powers, you could say, between the executive branch or any political official and the Federal Reserve. And I go into that a lot in the book, about what happens, some of the ramifications and historical examples of the White House trying to meddle in what the Fed is doing. And what we're seeing now, like you said, Mike, is that, you know, Trump came on the scene, and in 2018, 2019, he called Powell a bonehead. Even though he picked Powell, he said, "I want you to be my Federal Fed chair." And then he was unhappy that Chair Powell was exercising independence and raising or talking about raising interest rates when maybe that wouldn't be good for Trump's economy and get his reelection bid and his political ambitions. And Biden, in his own manner, is doing the same thing. He should not say anything about the Fed, but he's kind of doing this wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You betcha they're gonna cut interest rates. And you can't deny the fact that a cut in interest rates anytime this year will be good for Joe Biden.
Salim, when you think about, you know, you and I appreciate the connection you're drawing between this administration and the previous one in terms of the fusion or presence of politics as it relates to the Department of the Treasury, or at least the Federal Reserve. You've had the benefit of previously, you know, before covering, you know, the U.S. economy, right? Obviously in another country. I believe it was in Norway, if I remember correctly. What's the difference you find, at least as it relates to that marriage of politics and, you know, and really our other offices within D.C. versus in another country, in terms of, is it similar? Do you find that the U.S. has been a little unique in the fact that politics is starting to permeate, you know, so many different sectors of the government and our lives? Do we stand alone in there, or just in your experience, is this a trend that you're seeing other places, or are we, you know, a number one like we allege in many other things in this world?
I love this question. I love being able to talk about Norway for a minute. I did live there for 5 years. And actually, my interest in government currency policy, I think the germ of it was when I was living in Norway covering Scandinavian monetary policy and economic policy. Norway is a really small country. I've also lived in the UK, but I didn't cover it as such. But, you know, European countries, it's one, it's kind of like if the U.S. was broken up into 50 states and everyone was somewhat individual but trying to work together. Europe is a monetary union, not a fiscal union. So they don't share a budget or a fiscal policy, but they do share they share interest rate setting and monetary policy, which causes some interesting dynamics. Norway is separate. It's not part of the union like that. In Norway, you know, it's a very provincial country. They have a lot of power of their own because they're the owner of the world's biggest sovereign wealth fund. They have so much oil. They've poured that into just one fund for the future, and they're Europe's biggest investor. So their interest rates and their currency, the Norwegian kroner, has influence on Europe. Because they're a commodities, oil-driven market with this big investment power. But in the U.S., it's just something different. You know, the role on the world stage is much bigger. The responsibility is much bigger. People are looking to the U.S. for help, but also looking to the U.S. to blame problems on the U.S. It's this almost, you know, it's King Dollar. So it has the same effect of being a leader that is going to make you happy and unhappy at the same time.
So Leah, you know, before we let you go, one of the things that we like to do here with authors, and like I said, you can go get the book. It's out now wherever books are sold. Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. We like to do this all the time where there's a bookstore. It could be a plausible example for you. Your book is in the corner. You see somebody gravitate towards it. They grab it. They look at it. You tap them on the shoulder and you say, "Hey, I wrote that book." Now give them a reason why they should go to the counter and buy the book.
I love this. This is great. First of all, I think I would buy their book because I think there's something that authors are supposed to do where if you see someone out in the wild with your book, you should buy it because it's the first one that you've seen, which I would definitely do. I think I'm going to carry $30 around my pocket for that. That's such a great, I think my pitch would be that this is a book written by someone with a unique worldview. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. I lived in London and Norway. I am now in Washington. I'm trying to connect what happens in all of the parts of the country together and how it affects the rest of the world with a view. You know, I didn't come from like a mainstream background, Ivy League college, that kind of thing. I grew up in the heartland, and I am now seeing what happens in the elite policymaking circles. And I see the efforts that people are making to understand the electorate that is in some of the so-called flyover states. But I am trying to help evolve that conversation too.
She does a great job. Like I mentioned, you can check out all of her work over at Bloomberg or go listen to that Big Take DC podcast. I'm telling you, and I told you this in January, I started listening to it. It's one of my favorites. It's on my list there. So Saleha Mohsen, go get the book wherever books are sold. I can't thank you enough for hopping on the program today, giving us some time. Continued success to you, and please stay safe.
Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by KitCaster. KitCaster books you on top podcasts. How do funded startup founders attract prospects and talent? Podcast interviews. How do entrepreneurs with exits find new deals? Podcast interviews. How do C-suite execs differentiate in crowded markets? Podcast interviews. KitCaster books you on top podcasts. Click the link in the show notes for a special offer. Celebrate good conversation.
All right, our thank yous there to Saleha Mohsen. Like I mentioned, Bloomberg News correspondent. You can go check out the Big Take DC podcast that she hosts. It's fantastic. Go listen to it wherever you get your pods. Also, go check out the book, Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. It's actually a really good book. We've started to read it now. Well, me. I know you read it already, Nick. But, I mean, it's actually a really good book. And shout out to Saleha for coming on the program, explaining a lot there. All right, as you hear the music here, we're going to say farewell to somebody who didn't even get a chance to really do much. If you don't know what I'm talking about, this past week, maybe you're not on social media, maybe you don't even watch this show that I'm going to reference, but recently, the former RNC chair, that means Republican National Committee, for those of you who don't know, Ronna McDaniel, she had stepped down because now, obviously, former President Donald Trump put his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, now in charge of it. So she had stepped aside, and now trying to figure out what she was going to do next, she decided to enter into the TV world. Welcome to my game, Ronna. And faster than I did, she was able to get a contract from NBC News. But as fast as she got that contract, it was taken away from her because of all of the social media protests, outbursts from people saying they would never watch NBC News again. Because of some of the things that she has said recently on television, she has said that the election was stolen from former President Trump, and she faced a lot of criticism, right? And a lot of people were saying, why would you platform somebody like that that doesn't believe in what Nick and I always allude to on the show, right and wrong? So this past Sunday, NBC News and their famous show, Meet the Press, which airs at 11 o'clock on NBC, had Ronna on the show. She was going to be announced as a contributor. There's been reports that she's getting paid up to $300,000 by the network to be a contributor. Again, shout out to her because I have not been made one by a major network. So I'm a little jealous, but we'll get into that in a second. But here's Ronna McDaniel. She's about to go on Meet the Press on Sunday with Kirsten Welker, and they have an interview, just a frank discussion. Like, tell us why you left the RNC. What are you doing now? Why are you here? Take a listen to this.
Take me behind the scenes a little bit. Were you pushed out of your role?
Well, there's no question that as RNC chair, you have to remain neutral. And we had a primary process. And so we did have debates, right? We had debates and there was tension and a little friction that started during that process. It was well played out in the media. And I knew at that point when I was doing that role and we were going to have debates that when the nominee came forward and it was likely to be President Trump, that they would want to switch. And that's his right as nominee.
And so were you pushed out by him?
He absolutely wanted me to move aside and wanted Michael Whatley and Lara Trump to come in.
And you say you were neutral. You did put out that statement before he was officially the presumptive nominee, effectively calling on Nikki Haley to step out of the race. Can you say you were really neutral?
I can. I mean, we had a neutral primary. We had debates. I mean, look at the Democrats. They didn't have debates. Now they have RFK Jr. running as a third party. Imagine how the world would be different if they'd have allowed those debates to take place. I think that's so important to our public discourse. So yes, I was neutral. But as I said at that time, there was no math and no path. And that was true.
Now, look, why are we talking about this, right? I mean, in the grand scheme of things, if I hadn't mentioned Ronna McDaniel, and I'm sure some of you that listen to the show probably know who she is. Nick's going to dive in a little bit on her in a second. But for those of you that don't know who she is, or maybe you don't even watch Meet the Press, you don't watch cable news, you don't even watch news that's on, you know, the regular 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11 type channels of back in the day of straight linear TV. Why are we talking about this? It's not that big a deal. And it isn't. I mean, this is pretty much commonplace. This happens all the time where high profile political operatives, to use the word that everybody's been tossing around social media and in articles, they get TV gigs. That's what happens when you leave a public office and you head back into not really the private sector. You still stay in the public domain and you just become on television. We've had a few of those folks on, as well as me trying to do that, even though I never worked for an administration, et cetera. The difference is here, and what everyone's pointing to, is twofold. The reason we're covering it is because Meet the Press has been ranked number one in total viewers on Sunday as of this last check back in February 21st of 24. 2.6 million viewers watched Meet the Press. Over 6 million viewers watched the digital clips or shorts of it. That's just across a couple of platforms. That's not measured across everywhere. So it does have reach. It does have, from a social aspect, those clips are taken and other accounts are pushing that stuff out. And that is where former Meet the Press host Chuck Todd, who happened to be on the show himself afterwards, really dove deep into how the NBC bosses should be apologizing to Welker. He said on air, "I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation, because I don't know what to believe. She's now a paid contributor. I have no idea whether any answer she gave to you was because she didn't want to mess up her contract. She wants us to believe that she was speaking for the RNC when the RNC was paying for her." And that in lies the issue, is that people still think that she's now the mouthpiece for either the Trump campaign or the RNC side. It's not about hiring a Republican, because Republicans get hired all the time. I've been on panels with a bunch. You've seen me. If you don't have watched this show, you've noticed who I've been on, right? I've been on with Alice Stewart and some other folks, and some of them have been on this show. But they believe in right and wrong. They believe in fact fiction. Ronna McDaniel has not done any of those things and has clear examples of that. Nick, we bid adieu to her and her career. Who knows? She'll probably be back on the network. She gets booked on TV all the time. Again, she ran the biggest, second biggest, depending upon which side you look at it, political committee chair in this country. So obviously she has the experience of doing that. She lives in the MAGA universe and speaks MAGA. So she's going to, at least you get subject matter expertise about that from her. Am I wrong here? Why are we talking about Ronna McDaniel being an NBC News contributor or not being one?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the name carries attention, but it doesn't carry any credibility. You know, she has been known to be critical of the press. She echoes very similar statements to the former president about fake news. You know, in 2020, you know, it was reported that she had tried to apply pressure to Michigan County officials to not certify the election in the Detroit area. She apparently told officials in terms of certification, quote unquote, "Do not sign it. We will get you attorneys." So she is a believer in the fact the election of 2020 was not clean, despite numerous lawsuits that have been, you know, attempting to prove that, none of which have been proven correct. So she's not a credible person. So it begged the question, why would a news organization want to give her more time to really spew more nonsense? Because when we say that, well, you know, she was head of the RNC, who cares? I mean, put it this way. So you have someone who even if I didn't have an RNC, right, it's still Trump's party to lose. It was that way even in 2016 or even in 2015 when the nomination process began. Did the RNC probably want Trump to be the presumptive nominee? Of course not. So now she became RNC chair in 2016. So she becomes that role, you know, when Trump becomes president. And she's been a Trump supporter the whole time. The clip you played, she said about being, you know, remaining neutral. She's never been neutral. She's very much a Trump supporter. But as Trump is prone to do, if you can't be effective enough in your job, which is to basically placate that maniac, like, he'll make sure you're gone. So he replaces her, you know, with someone a little more close to home. So, you know, this morning when I was thinking about this conversation, the question I asked myself was, who should be more embarrassed? You know, because if you're Ronna McDaniel, you're just trying to get a paycheck. But should you feel a little bit embarrassed because you're the only people who were going to give you the time of day is probably the least, at this point, the least credible news organization of the big three? Now, when I say credibility, obviously, you know, people on the left will say, well, what, you consider Fox to be credible? Not in the prime time, no. But you know, we have talked to enough journalists that they do seem like a credible news organization other than certain times of the day. MSNBC, however, has had questions about that. We even talked on this show about some of the actions they took to basically silence some of the voices, some of the brown voices on that network. That doesn't seem very credible to me. So here's a flailing news organization that, you know, throws a Hail Mary to bring on a clear MAGA voice, which is funny to me because, so, okay, you do this, you bring her on. Well, you alienate your audience. So the people that you thought you would bring on were never coming. So all you have is just your tribe, essentially, and you're trying to break them off. It's a little like when, I forgot what news organization brought on Megyn Kelly for a daytime show. I think it was NBC. It was the same thing, right? You bring on a popular face at Fox News. Who did you think you were going to win over? Because Fox News viewers are not going to like slough off over to NBC. And then on the other side of it, you know, you're NBC and you make this desperate attempt, which failed miserably. I'm fascinated by the fact that this didn't even get off the ground. I mean, all the constant Twitter jokes that you were sending over to me and I've been seeing all over. Now, do I believe social media backlash is the sole reason? I don't know. I mean, you got a lot, I imagine, a fairly older group of people making these decisions at the network. So are they all looking at the tweets and saying, hey, you know, this doesn't look like it's going to fly? I don't know. I go to you on that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't think you make your decision. Maybe you plant something out there story-wise so you can kind of get a reaction, but you wouldn't have all the wheels in motion already. And look, I've said this a bunch, and a friend of mine that listens to the program has said this to me. It is truly hard to find people that try to be centrist, right? Because when you're overseeing a television network, right, when you're picking out these panels, look at the makeup and the composition of some of the panels that even I have been on. You can check out some of the panels if you go to our YouTube channel and type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. You'll see, right? There's somebody who's a Democratic strategist. There's somebody who's a Republican strategist. Those are the partisan people. Then you'll have reporters like Saleha, who's a Bloomberg, you know, news reporter. She covers the economy and the treasury, like she mentioned. You'll have Laura Barron Lopez, who's been on this show, who she covers the White House. So they have specific correspondents for that. Then you have people like me that are nonpartisan, right? We're calling the balls and strikes. We're umpires. But we are adjacent to all of this because we're covering it as well. We've interviewed members of Congress. The stuff that I'm doing with the Free and Equal Elections Foundation, and Nick and I have been participating with some of that. Like, now we're at least ensconced in this, right? So we can lend some subject matter expertise to debates and things like that. So everybody has their own lane. But it's kind of like what you said. Ronna doesn't have a lane other than that she was the RNC chair. And like what you said, so what? I mean, Doug High ran the RNC and he's not in that field. He believes in right and wrong. I say all that to say, we're talking about this because I agree with you. When you're a network and you're, again, it goes back to the right and wrong thing. It's not about an R&D thing. I can find an R and I can find a D anywhere. Pause, you know, if you know the Cam and Mace reference. But you really should not hire somebody that doesn't believe in right and wrong. Like, it's that simple. And we leave it there. because right and wrong is the center of this show. And Nick is cracking up because of the Cam and Mace reference. If you don't get that, go watch It Is What It Is with Cam and Mace. And for our show, video portions, you want to check out the video portion of our interview with Saleha, head over to our YouTube channel. Like I just mentioned, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. We should pop right up. Audio podcast platforms, you know by now, Apple, Spotify, Google. Shout out to everybody listening to us over on Good Pods. Shout out to Acast, our hosting platform. We can't do it without them. We can't do it without each and every one of you that listens to this program. As always, I'm Mike Leon.
Goodness sakes, pay my boy. Pay Mike. I'm Nick Zimmer.
That's right. He messed his name up. I don't mess my name up on air. We'll see everybody next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.